No, I was thinking of the, you know, the Baptists and the Presbyterian and so forth, that they have church schools too, you know.
Yes, they do.
Absolutely.
Last I checked, the Seventh-day Adventists and farms and...
But we felt that at least sometimes churches might be built in an EFU zone that might better have been sited within the urban growth boundary. I guess that would be my defense of that particular point.
Yeah, I don't want to debate the point right here. I want to continue with your review, if you would, please.
No, let's see, we're at the top of page 7.
No, we're at page 6 yet. We need to look...
Oh, yes. Further down. Okay, what
do you want to take line 14?
Oh, okay, here we are with a dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. If the dwelling is on a lot or parcel that is managed as part of a farm unit, not smaller than the minimum lot size in a farm zone, this would be an outright use for a farm home, provided the farm unit is of the size that is recognized as being the size that's needed for that kind of a farm.
This recognizes the reality that farms today are not always like they were 50 or 100 years ago, that some farmers are farming with several parcels that might make up a total of 100 or 200 acres, but I mean, it might be 10 acres here and 20 acres there and 30 or somewhere something else. And so this takes care of that provision.
This speaks specifically to those counties which have a minimum lot size. And a number of counties now do not have a minimum lot size, and they're taken care of under the conditional use section because they've already made it a conditional use process. But anyway, in those counties that have a minimum lot size, we say if the farm is of that particular size that rates being a farm unit, and those are recognized, why, then they can get it outright. Then down on line 23, we put a new type of thing, which I think is educational perhaps as much as anything, but anyway, we say that in the cases of a farm that may be sold to a that a farm may be sold to a neighbor, that farm dwelling could easily be used as a life estate for the person that's on that. One of the arguments that we come up against is, well, you know, I want to retire and I want to live on my land, but I want to sell to my neighbor. Well, this can be done, of course, through a life estate process. And we thought we ought to recognize that in the law as a way of allowing that farmer to stay in the same neighborhood that he had been in when we have otherwise have not allowed new non-farm dwellings.
Mr. Chairman, didn't we do something in that area last time? I thought we went for the Farmer Jones Amendment. Didn't that do it?
And the Farmer Jones Amendment, and Mr. Sadlow isn't here to help me out, but as I understood that, was to provide a place for relatives. And what we're concerned about is the farms where the active farmer wants to retire and needs the money, wants to sell his farm, but
okay,
he still wants
to get out of
here.
It entirely.
He wants to get out of it entirely. And the problem is that some counties would like to, or some have ordinances, to permit the cutoff of that farmhouse. And oftentimes that farmhouse is the only high spot, for instance, in a farm that's composed of floodplain, or another situation, the farm that we have farmed, the farmhouse was right in the middle of this large farm. And to cut that out would really be a destroying part of that farm operation. And so we're saying that a life estate would be a reasonable and a good way. Okay. It is already provided for in law. I would like to suggest that, you notice there's a blank there where it says not to exceed so many acres. You may want to put an acreage designation there. We feel that that's not terribly important. You could even delete the words not to exceed blank acres, because I think that the farmer purchasing the farm and the farm owner who wants to stay in that farmhouse would know the right number of acres. I don't think that's going to be misused.
That would be our suggestion, I think, to simply delete not to exceed acres, blank acres. In sub 2 at the bottom, we go now to the conditional uses that we have in an EFU zone. We've added language there which, if the use meets reasonable standards adopted by the governing body, that's simply to make it clear that counties can set standards themselves. But we go to our changes then on page 7. Now we get a dwelling in conjunction with farm use. This is a farm dwelling we're talking about, which we're making a conditional use now. But we say that on a lot or parcel that is managed as part of a farm unit not smaller than 20 acres. So we're setting some standards here now as to what a farm dwelling can be, because as we look to the future, particularly as we say that there will be no more non-farm dwellings, everyone is going to try and qualify as a farm dwelling. So we think it's highly important that at this point we set some standards for what a farm dwelling can be. And we do this by saying that in a unit not smaller than 20 acres or than the average farm of the county producing $20,000 in gross income, as defined in so-and-so, of the crops and livestock to be raised on the farm, whichever is larger. And if the farm operation is smaller than the average farm described in this paragraph or smaller than 20 acres, whichever is larger, a mobile home as defined in so-and-so may be allowed. So what we're saying here is that if you're a young farmer, not making $20,000, you come in and you want to put a house out there, well, yes, you can put a mobile home out there, but once you've met the income test, then you can build your permanent home, but better prove it first. This takes care of all the little operations that people come in with a farm plan saying, yes, I'm going to be a farmer, but then they never really carry through on it, and soon they get discouraged to move out, but you've got your dwelling there. Okay, a mobile home can be moved.
Now, again, the reason for putting this language in is that as soon as you delete non-farm housing from the farm zones, then there is going to be a flood of applications, or the people who would like to live in the country are going to come in and say, but our dwelling is a farm dwelling, and so we need to have specific definitions, and the legislature needs to give those definitions rather than depending on the county or the LCDC to do that. Now, we have one problem, and I'm not sure how you want to edit this to take care of this, but we would like to see that, let's say someone has a 20-acre vineyard or an orchard, is an area where they're doing small farming and want to plant an orchard or a vineyard. The expenses are very high in getting that orchard or vineyard established. They need tax deferral then, if they ever do, I mean, when they're not getting much income. And we would like to somehow have that language say that even if it doesn't produce $20,000 now, if the orchard or vineyard is established so that it's going to produce $20,000 when it comes into full production, that then they could go ahead and build their own home. We don't want to penalize the orchardist or the person who's working with perennial crops. Even blueberries would come in that category also, I believe. And I'm not sure that we have adequate language there, but legal counsel may know how to amend that accordingly.
We go then to the adding back in the private and public schools and churches, which we've already discussed. I don't need to comment on that further. Then we drop down to the additions to the gravel extraction language that we think is appropriate. One of the biggest problems we have in our area is that the gravel extraction seems to be on the very best land. It happens that that's the class 1 and 2 river bottom soils along the Willamette River. And these are being used and completely destroyed as far as agriculture goes from, you know, time immemorial. That's nothing temporary. It's a permanent destruction. And we say it would be much more reasonable to exhaust the gravel that's under some of the poorer soils before we go to exhausting those and taking more of that class 1 and 2 soil that is so valuable for gravel extraction. We'll go down then to the next section, and on line 21, this language here came from the other bill that you're supposedly holding hearings on, to the interim committee bill, and we found that they were not doing just what we had in mind here. So we're going to suggest a change in that language as well. So where you notice that we start with community centers, and it says community centers owned and operated by a government agency and so on. Now, we want to move the parks, playgrounds, and campgrounds, along with the community centers, and say that they should be owned by a government agency or a nonprofit community organization, because we want to keep KOAs out of a farm zone. So we're saying that those should be government organizations, but we allow hunting and fishing preserves to be where they are down at the bottom, which means that they would not have to be, they could be private, because they tend to be not things that are developmentally organized, but tend to be open land type of activities. The next change, of course, is that we have deleted golf courses. I think we touched on that when we discussed it before. I'm sure you're going to hear some opposition to that one.
Hector, would you refresh my memory on that, on the golf course?
On the golf course, ma'am.
Why did you do that?
Yes. We think that golf courses most appropriately should be within an urban growth boundary. Golf courses are an attraction for urban type living. They should be located close to it. Also, they are, you know, they're sizable, so that they use quite a little bit of land. And therefore, we think that any time that a golf course is proposed, there should be an extensive hearing process go through. So we would say that a golf course should be taken out of the EFU zone as such, and that an exception be used if one needs to be sited there. And certainly this does not keep golf courses out of it, but it simply says that it's a procedure in which you would have to consider whether there are alternate sites that would be appropriate for the golf course before you could grant it.
If the urban growth boundary of a given location didn't have space for a golf course, and if there was need for a golf course in that community, then they could go through the exceptions process. But you wouldn't put it in an EFU zone without exhausting all the other options.
We go on then, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, Dave.
Will this affect any current golf courses under construction or applying?
None under construction. The one that certainly will come to mind to a number of people, though, is the OSU golf course, in which they just recently lost a case, and so they're down to ground zero again, so it really would affect them. It would affect them.
That's what I thought. I just thought we ought to get that out in the open. What?
Right, that's appropriate.
Let me ask you something else. Destination resorts, what do you deal with that in here?
Exceptions process, Senator Day.
In other words, there'd be no destination resorts allowed in EFU areas.
Unless you go through the exceptions process.
That's rather laborious, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I don't think there would be too many in an EFU zone that would be appropriate. Now, there may be places. It's much more of a problem, I think, in the forestry zones. But we have not provided for it here, other than through the exceptions process.
Again, may I go back to one of the comments we made last week? One of the requests which Agriculture of Oregon has of the legislature and of the communities, the governing bodies, is that agriculture be given the same kind of protection that you give to industrial zoning or to commercial zoning, but particularly to industrial zoning, because agriculture is a very important part of the economic base of the state of Oregon, and we need to protect it. And destination resorts may detract from the viability of agriculture. Certainly in some areas it would.
Page 8 is all old language, but I won't dwell on that and turn to page 9, because here we get the distinction that we pointed out, where in eastern Oregon we still allow non-farm dwellings. In other words, residential dwellings not provided in conjunction with farm use, which we do not allow in western Oregon. So we use the same things that we have in the statute at the present time, which apply all over the state, and simply restrict it to eastern Oregon. But we've made some rather substantial changes in the middle of that page, which is, after all, this is the interim committee bill, which is the same, has the same language in it, and we think this is quite appropriate. To take you back, when this language was put in Senate Bill 101 in 1973, we lifted from the Marion County Ordinance how they handled this thing. We've had 10 years now of court tests and so on, and we find these first three tests that were that are currently in the statute are not very helpful in determining whether a house can be built in a farm zone. So we've substituted for all three of those this A, which is on line 12, which says that a dwelling or activities associated with a dwelling will not force a major change or measurably increase the cost of accepted farming practices on nearby lands devoted to farm use. The test there, and the one that puts the teeth in it, is measurably increase, because this seems to me an appropriate test. A non-farm home going into that area would have to be judged by the test now of whether the farming that was going on around it had to be changed measurably, so there was an increased cost like changing a spray pattern or this kind of a thing, and that would be a test that would be certainly easier to prove in court than these very general ones that we've deleted. The next one down, this is the dwelling situated on generally unsuitable land. And we've left the first part of that the same, except that we would like to have the word vegetation deleted. They brought in the fact that, well, there are trees on this land, therefore I can't farm it, and it shouldn't therefore be considered farmland. And we think that's inappropriate, so we would delete the word vegetation, and that's not deleted on your copy.
Is that on line 17?
That's on line 17. And then we simply conform this to the case law that we already have in the Rutherford case, and we say that a lot or parcel shall not be considered unsuitable solely because of its size or location if it can reasonably be put to a farm use in conjunction with other land. The Rutherford case, as you may recall, was a case where there was a small, I believe it was a 5 or 10 acre parcel that was being farmed by a neighbor, but they said it was too small, but because it had a history of farming, it was turned over by the courts, and that is a part of case law. Now, C.
Line 23, we just clarify our definition of Eastern Oregon or Western Oregon, including Hood River County, with the counties that are east that are west of the crest of the Cascade Range.
Okay, then in Section 6, we go to the land divisions section of 215. And
we make provision for the possibility of a hearings officer by adding the words, or its designate. At that change from page 9 to 10. And that happens also in line 6 on page 10. And we'll get to that concept of hearings officer a little later here.
The big change in here starts on line 12. And this is the one that creates a panel of farmers.
Not yet.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, and here we're talking about land divisions here.
I'm sorry.
We're talking about land divisions.
Creates panels for non-farm use. Okay. Getting ahead of myself here. The governing body of a county or designate may approve a proposed land division, a division of land in an exclusive farm use zone, if it finds that the parcel for the non-farm use is not larger than minimum lot size. And this simply is to give the county a handle on whether the school, the other things that might be provided, the non-farm uses, whether on the size that they might be. In other words, it's got to be appropriate to the size that was being proposed in the non-farm use.
I think what we mean there, Hector, on line 15, is that if a county in eastern Oregon approves a dwelling for non-farm use, that they should put with that dwelling only the minimum necessary size for that.
Well, I think you may be right, but I think it would apply to any non-farm
use. Any non-farm use, right.
Right, okay. Okay, now here's the next one, 1-4, on line 17. The governing body of a county may not approve a division of land in an exclusive farm use zone for a dwelling authorized in so-and-so. This is the one which says you cannot cut off a farm either in eastern or western Oregon.
No new non-farm parcels is what we're saying here.
Okay. Line 5.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Yes. The area of committed lands, will this apply?
Well, in the area of committed lands, we assume that the parcelization has already occurred.
Well, no, the committed lands are not EFU. Now, let's see. You can have EFU in the
committed lands. You bet you can have EFU in the committed lands.
Right. This would apply anywhere that you had EFU.
So it would affect committed lands if they're in EFU at this
time. If they're put into an EFU category, right.
But what would happen is that if the parcelization had occurred, then that could be looked at in eastern Oregon. If the parcelization had already occurred, a non-farm dwelling could be placed upon it. But if the parcelization had not happened, then they could not make a new parcel for a non-farm dwelling.
Well, you could have the parcelization, the way I read this, under 4. You could have the parcelization already done. It could be a committed land and still be an EFU and stop by sub 4.
Right, you'd have to take it out of if you want to cut it up more. You'd have to take it out of the EFU, the way I read this.
What if I'm not going to cut it up more? I'm going to take it out of EFU. Period. I mean, I don't want to use it anymore. It's a committed land. It shows committed on the comprehensive plan, except it's still in EFU. Some of it.
I don't see your problem.
Okay, I'll tell you right along I-5. I'll tell you where there's some problems, and I'll talk to you later about it. Okay.
Good.
Yes. Okay. On line 20, we say no subdivisions. The governing body of a county shall not approve a subdivision. And this, of course, subdivisions we think of in terms of land development. Question comes up, well, what do you do if you've got a 20,000-acre farm in eastern Oregon and you want to divide it up into 10 parcels? Well, you'd have to do it over a several-year period. You'd have to do it 1 year and then the next year and so on. You could get your 4 parcels 1 year and then you'd have to go on to the next, because if it technically fits the definition of subdivision, you couldn't do it. So you might want to look into that, but we don't think it's too significant.
That also, I believe, is in SB 234, comes out of the...
Yes. Okay, we're over to Section 7, which is the Planning and Hearings Officer Statute. And we get down to line 13, and we add in our farmer review panel. This permits a group of farmers then to be appointed by the county commissioners to review all land developments in an EFU zone. And we further say there on down below in the next section down that these have to go directly to the LUBA or its successor. In other words, they're not reviewable at the county level.
Now, this group of farmers would not be doing making legislative decisions, for instance, like the designation of what should go in EFU and what should go in marginal land. They would be functioning just like a hearings officer would function, reviewing permits for development on land zoned for EFU. In the House C&E Committee, as you may know, there was considerable discussion of a hearings officer, and at the time we were trying to come to some agreement on our own recommendations. We thought the idea of a hearings officer would be a very good idea. We understand that did not come through in the House committee because local government said it's too expensive. This would be something which would, at least in EFU zone, solve much of the same problem. It would take that decision on permits out of the political arena into a non-political situation, and at no cost to the county, because these would, of course, all be volunteers.
The very bottom of the page is the language that I spoke of. The farmer panel decisions go directly to LUBA. It says, shall provide that the decisions of the hearings officer on permits involving land in exclusive farming use zone is the final determination.
At the top of page 12, we come to a very important part of our recommendations. We believe that, and are recommending here, that any owner or farm operator of land in the county assessed a true cash value for farm use should be in the same category as someone who is aggrieved when it comes to the issue of standing for challenging land use actions.
So this is the area there on line 3 to 5, which would give standing to every farmer in an EFU zone.
Again, the rationale here is that agricultural land is of statewide concern, and parenthetically, I think the same thing is true of forest land, but we're a group of farmers, not foresters, and so we don't have the skills, we haven't really grappled with that. But if agricultural land is of statewide concern, then it seems that somehow we need to broaden standing in cases involving agricultural issues so that the whole cost of going through evidentiary hearings. Benton County, for instance, recently took a group that I'm a part of in Benton County, not only through LUBA. Well, we won the case at LUBA, but Benton County then challenged our standing that LUBA had granted and took it through the appeals court and the Supreme Court. We were granted standing all the way through, but this was at a tremendous cost to the taxpayers, who had to pay the bill for the county attorney, who had to pay the bill for the court process also. And we think that this would really be a saving of dollars to the state of Oregon if that standing issue were broadened then.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
The Hansel Committee came just completely diabolically to the opposite feeling, that we should narrow standing, whether it be on this issue, because of the inordinate amount of appeals for mischief making that this allows. And not that I don't want the farmers involved, or not that I don't think agricultural lands are important, but I just wonder how there was nothing in their findings and hearings over statewide effort. This was one of the largest complaints they had of all the things in their report. How do you address that?
Well, let me argue for our stand, and I think it's a good one, and I'm certainly prepared to back it, in that the problem you get into, if you let only the people within sight and sound of a particular thing, and you buy off those neighbors, nearby neighbors, how do you get at this thing that's going on throughout the county? I think it affects every farmer in that county if you establish a precedent in one area, and then try to apply it somewhere nearer to my farm. So I think that what we need to do is to allow standing, but have a fast, efficient system to handle those cases. And I don't think that you're going to have very many cases when you get to the point where counties do their job. I think a lot of times we've had now is that counties aren't doing their job, and we need to have standing there to bring them up to the to the standards of the law.
That's a controversial. I don't want to.
Yes, let's not go on. We're trying to explain the bill today.
Right. We'll talk about 5 minutes. So
we'll try to wind this up very quickly now. On page 12, we go into the subdivision law. The page 12 is simply conforming language. We go over on page 13, we get where we say that counties must review minor petitions. And the only reason for this is that some counties have still not adopted a minor petition ordinance. So we say that they must review minor petitions in an EFU zone, because of course this is the kind of thing that can get us in trouble. And we go to section 11 over on page 15 now, which is the update of the undeveloped subdivision law. And in this, we do the vacating of lot lines and take care of that particular problem. We expand the language of the present law to include partitions. And then in section 12, we require the vacating of lot lines of after 3 years for divisions that may not have may have been appropriate at the time they were put in, but are left sitting out there. And we do that, I guess. Let's see. We give them 3 years. Let's see.
On line three, you talk about 3 years after the date of approval of the partition. If it hasn't been acted upon, then those lot lines are erased for planning purposes.
This is a grace period so that we can take care of the problems out there, presumably before we actually erase the lot line. But and then the next section, of course, is this is all new language, and the section down here where we actually erase the lot lines begins on line seven. Into a single parcel whose contiguous parcels in which greater than possessory interest is held by the same person or persons. That requires the consolidation. And then we go on to say that vacations do not affect tax lot lines.
Now, I'd like to have you turn on this sheet, the Ag for Oregon sheet, to page six, the last page. SB 237 does not include the tax amendments, and I'm not sure under what how you plan to bring those in.
I'm going to have you talk about those at our next hearing, all right?
Good. Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a good presentation. We've covered, as I've mentioned before, those of you that are here on 234, we've covered basically the same issues. So I'm going to kind of alternate from the list here, and we're going to try to get you as many of you in as we can on both of those bills. And I'm going to take the... start out with Mr. Robert Davis.
My name is Bob Davis. I'm owner of St. Helens Golf Course, and I'm also president of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association. And I'm here on short notice objecting to the deletion of golf courses as a conditional use. I didn't have any background to prepare for this, although I can, as an example, in Columbia County at one time there were many dairies, and changing economic conditions and also government regulations requiring handling of milk has practically reduced the dairy industry to two or three large dairies. My golf course is built on an old dairy. It's outside of a present urban growth boundary, and I was curious why it was excluded here, and the reasoning that golf courses could better be located near or in an urban growth boundary is not reasonable because of the costs involved. If you will ask the gentleman from the National Golf Foundation, if he gets a chance to talk tonight, what it costs to construct an 18-hole golf course today, excluding the cost of the land, you'll understand why most golf courses are built on farmland, and usually it's marginal farmland, or areas such as mine that are no longer economically feasible as farmland, and that's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr.
I hope I do justice to your name. It looks like James Maresch.
My name is Jim Marsh. I have a commercial vineyard and orchard in the Red Hills of Dundee, about 100 acres. And I would just like to support Mr. McPherson's comments regarding the aggregate extraction section, whereby we feel that we need to tighten that section to, in effect, prioritize the extraction of rock from the let's say the poorer soils, allow the extraction there first, and then to proceed to the better soils. A case in point, in this rapidly growing vineyard section in the Red Hills of Dundee, a substantial amount of acreage has already been destroyed. Beautiful vineyard sites that are capable of producing an annual gross income of about $5,000 per year, probably, you know, for the next 100 years. So I just believe that the language as it is presented here